you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. You're about to hear the continuation of the epic Romano-Saxon War by Josh Hutchins. This is the audio version of our first Twilight Histories book, written by Josh Hutchins. If you're enjoying this series, I highly recommend you pick up the book. And now, on to the story.
A small gust blows through the fire, making its orange coals glow brightly for a moment. I wrap my cloak around my shoulders more tightly. The fire is putting off dark smoke due to the wetness of the wood. It smells of smoke, I guess. I grab another handful of moist sand and let it fall through my fingers. I sigh, tasting morning breath. The sky over the water is dark like ink. Behind me, dark gray with a hint of blue. Another gust of wind. I hear it whip up the flames. A wave crests and pushes folds of seaweed ashore, only to be dragged back out to sea again. I watch the sand fall from my palm again, running its coarse grains between my thumb and fingers. My stomach aches, along with my throat.
I thought I would find you here, apprentice.
I turn, slightly startled. Thought you'd find me here?
Yes. I knew you'd be alone, wherever you were.
She walks towards the water and folds her arms across her chest. The summer breeze carries her long strands of gray blonde hair behind her.
I love the sea. The water. It is what it is, and it's always here.
She turns. I keep my eyes on the small stack of burning driftwood, careful not to meet her eyes. I hear her exhale through her nose.
You know, apprentice, I was very angry at you for what you did last night, but not now.
I slowly look up. She meets my eyes and smiles.
Oh, don't be silly. I thought of cutting off your penis last night, apprentice.
I shrug.
But kind hearts say your penis saves Saxony, so how could I do this?
She moves to stand closer to the fire, and I notice she isn't wearing any shoes. Gray sand slips between her long toes.
Even so, we did not finish the Blood Eagle. Freya is pleased. You did stab Sextus through the heart with flaming sword, did you not?
I clear my throat.
Yeah, I guess I did. And I know why you did this, apprentice.
I turn my head to look at her. She slowly stretches her lips into a smile.
I am certain my Ingrid would have done the same. You two were much alike.
She turns to face the ocean and speaks as if no longer addressing me.
I cannot keep you here, apprentice. You are too soft. Too weak. You may be a good commander. You may even be good man. But you cannot stay here in Saxony.
I guess I did openly defy you in front of everyone.
She
turns her head to give me a sideways sneer. Yes, there is that as well. She turns back to the sea and stands silent for many minutes. The wind blows a little harder, and the dark gray in the sky has turned to a pale gray. She slaps her hands on her thighs, as if wiping them clean, then turns to warm them with the fire.
I have your boats. You can leave whenever you want, so long as my fishermen have their boats back before 2 moons.
I nod.
Saxon fishermen tell stories of you to every man they see. One man, a chief named Bidvir, and other Angles have asked to join you. I told them they must seek your approval, not mine.
Angles?
Yes. They are savages. Barely men at all. Some say they become wolves during a full moon.
She looks at the moonless sky.
But people are fools.
I give a chuckle.
One more thing, apprentice.
She switches to a strange language.
I know not why Potsa, baby killer, call Hecate.
I hold my lips tight, but don't stray from her gaze.
Freya, tell me, Hecate cannot be trusted.
She doesn't say anything else. I don't say anything. We just stare at each other.
Here.
She holds out a small leather pouch in her hand. What's this? She smiles and turns her eyes and hands back to the fire.
Something to loosen Hecate's tongue.
I tug the leather cord loose to see a small jumble inside the pouch. You want me to give her shrooms?
Mushrooms, mixed with other herbs. She will tell you all she know.
Dergos must see the confusion on my face.
Just put some in her food, perhaps in some ale. She need not eat any of it. The essence alone will make her talkative. Crush them first, but not too soon. They become less effective after time.
Thank you, I say, pulling the cord tight again and placing the pouch in an inner pocket of my cloak. She takes a deep breath.
Now, you will see there are more than enough boats for you. Some I had built. Others I buy. Others are from the Angles. With the gold and treasure you bring me, I will expand Saxon power. I expect you to be on friendly terms with Saxony once you conquer all the Grey Island.
She arches her eyebrows. I nod, and she smiles.
I give you my blessing to leave Saxony with an army to kill Romans on the Grey Island. Take all their land and hold it as your own. I give this blessing, even though many 100 Roman heads you bring me are from horses.
I tilt my head. Roman horses have Roman heads.
That is exactly what your friend said you would tell me.
Kindheart holds a leather bundle over his head, and someone on board the ship hauls it inside. A line of some 30 people, similarly burdened, make their way like ants toward the ships. I hold my hand to my brow, shielding my eyes from the noonday sun. Along the beach, for several hundred yards, the pattern repeats itself. Nearly 80 boats and 6,000 men and women. Dergos comes to stand directly in front of me.
Apprentice, you look well.
She smiles and turns to observe the scene around us, then turns back to me. Loading the boats will take some time. Come, come with me and bring your men. A short line of people. Kynhard, Praxos, Glycerin, Egric, myself, Hecate, some fat guy named Bidvir, and about a half dozen others, including Daragos, walk back through the village and take a strange turn into the forest. The canopy blots out the sun, but it seems to trap in the heat. Our footfalls are muffled by the thick layer of dead leaves. We push low-hanging branches aside, like swinging doors, as we hike single file deeper into the trees. Bugs begin to snap at my exposed skin. Mosquitoes make their high-pitched buzz as they inspect my ear holes. Every few moments, a member of our party slaps at their skin. The earthy smell of recent rain is now masked by Dark Age armpits. I turn to look at Glycerin. Where the hell are we going? He holds his hands out in an exaggerated shrug, then slaps at an insect on his forearm. I just hope we bloody well get there soon. We walk for what has to be an hour, maybe two. I try to see around the people in front of me, but it's like we're walking through a tunnel of brush. I start to say something, but the limbs fall away as I step into a small clearing. We're at the edge of a placid lake. Its surface is like a perfect mirror, reflecting the clear sky above. A flock of birds bustle out of a nearby treetop. After they fade into the distance, and our entire party is joined on the shore of the lake, I realize there is no sound. There are no bugs, no wind, waves, nothing. I can almost hear my heartbeat. Daragos points to a pair of small boats tied to an ancient tree stump at the edge of the water. Kynhard nods me over to him.
This is sacred ground, apprentice. We must be very quiet.
We clamber into the boats, being as reverent as possible. As we take the paddles and push off from the grassy bank, I notice there is an island at the center of the lake. It's crowned with the largest tree I've ever seen. Daragos sits at the front of one of the boats, facing the island as we gently ply the calm waters toward it. When we reach the shore, we leave the boats and walk onto the island. The tree is impossibly large. It must be 20 feet in diameter. Its boughs shade nearly the entire island, and I cannot see the top of it. I can't even determine what kind of tree it is. If I had my old chip installed, it would identify the tree instantly. Then it would tell me the Latin biological name, the etymology, its history, what parts are edible, etc. Without my chip, it looks like an oak tree, I think. Daragos approaches a low altar at the base of the tree. The altar looks like it's hewn of onyx, very dark. Sitting on it is an antlered headdress, which she places on her head and turns to face us.
Apprentice, unbelt your sword, she says.
I know better than to hesitate, so I do as she says and hand it to her. She holds the scabbard in her slightly outstretched hands.
This is its original scabbard?
I nod my head.
The stones embedded in the surface are fine indeed.
She hands the scabbard to me and grabs the sword by the hilt, slowly drawing it. There's the soft whisper of steel on leather. She holds the blade, laying atop her palms, looking at it with her hawk eyes.
The craftsmanship, the caliber of this blade is extraordinary.
She traces the wavy Damascus steel lines with her fingertip.
Where did you get this sword?
My friend made it, back in Britannia. His name was Aristus.
Did he give this blade a name?
I shrug. If he did, he never told it to me. She turns and walks to the edge of the water, still holding my blade like it's some sort of sacred artifact. The water makes soft, sloshing sounds as she wades into the lake, up to her waist. I hear her muttering some sort of prayer or chant as she dips my sword into the water once, twice, thrice. She walks back and holds it out to me.
Our Lady Freya has blessed this sword, the man who carries it, and the men he leads. I charge you, apprentice, with the wisdom and strength of Freya. Take it, and carry with you the soul of Saxony to all the world. Take this sword and cut down your enemies.
She motions to the huge tree.
Here, at the foot of the great Yggdrasil, where our Lady Freya's power is strongest, in the sacred waters of our secret lake, and with the blood of Saxony herself, I bless you, apprentice.
She grasps the blade of my sword and pushes her hands towards me, cutting her skin deeply. Blood begins to ooze from the wounds as she holds her hands high. She mutters another strange prayer with her eyes closed. Then her eyes snap open, and she smears warm red blood across my face. The people on the shore grow smaller and smaller as our ship bobs and tumbles over each wave, carried by a strong breeze. Kindheart's long hair blows into my face. Dude, can you manage your flowing manlocks? I have my mouth open.
Here, let me help you,
Hecate says, as she begins to pull Kindheart's hair back into a large bird nest of a ponytail. Then she ties it with a small strip of cloth.
Thank you, my dear.
He pats her hand on his arm.
So, apprentice, tell me, what is first thing you wish to do when we reach Britannia? Piss on the island? Burn everything?
Easy there, Conan. Don't get carried away. We're looking to rule the place, not destroy it.
They may have to do both. Men of Britannia can be quite difficult. Just ask my dear Hecate.
She playfully pinches him.
And what is a Conan? Is this more Klingon talk?
I sniff and grin. But my answer is drowned out by a bellowing laugh. It's a rough yet hearty laugh, full of rasping. We turn to see Glyceron and Praxos in conversation with a large man. He isn't just large, he's rotund. I hold ropes and rigging and make my way on the swaying deck to sit next to the man. He's still laughing. He slaps me on the knee with a hand covered in pink scars.
This man say woman of place named Hispania are best. I say, Blumlock, good woman have broad hips and strong legs. I like woman with small hands. hands wrapped around my Nifrog make me look like giant.
Nifrog? He reaches between my legs.
Nifrog is...
I pull away sharply. All right. I know what it is now. I take a deep breath. Sitting next to him, I detect the strong odor of cloves and salt. He's wearing a ragged leather loincloth of sorts, held up by a belt which disappears under his gut in front. His skin, mostly masked with thick black wiry hair, shows large purple splotches and what looks like a strange splash pattern. He sees me looking at them.
My father tell me I had this scalp when I was born. Not know how to wash off.
Birthmarks, I say. Tell me, Bidve, what is the purpose of those metal studs in your nipples? Don't they hurt? He shrugs his beefy shoulders.
It did hurt at first, but no longer.
He slings back a drink of ale and wipes some dribble off his lips. I close my eyes. I would imagine this guy with a messy beard, but he has none. His chin is covered in scars, the scar tissue apparently preventing the growth of chin hairs. Even his head is bald, as if he'd shaved it this morning with an electro-laser razor, or used a chemical in the shower to remove his hair entirely. But I know he didn't shower this morning. I just know. Dergos told me you were an angle. He nods, with his lips pursed. Kynard shakes his head.
Angles, as if we don't have enough problems already.
Midvir laughs.
Come now, cousin. We will have so much fun together. Then apart, no?
Yes, but most angles I know don't even know when to stop the fun. 1 minute they are celebrating victory on the battlefield. The next minute angles are splashing around in human entrails like dogs in the mud. They play catch with internal organs. They feed blood to the children.
He shakes his head again and takes a drink.
Plans tend to go awry when the angles are involved.
If we live through all this, Kindheart, I'll tell you what the Nazis did to the... Never mind. The important thing is that we can trust them to fight. Midvir slaps himself on the chest.
We will fight, yes.
Praxa squints.
On our side.
His face stretches into a toothy grin.
Most of the time, yes.
Soon, we're all swapping stories. Drinking ale, eating smoked pork, feeling the cool breeze on our skin, and watching the sky turn a brilliant dark blue. I move to the rear of the boat and watch the stars. I wish Ingrid was here. My eyes mist over, and I sniffle quietly. Glycerin and Praxos tell Bidvir about our escape from Thorium's jail cells. He certainly laughs a lot. The boat sways, as if the sea surface were merely caressing the keel. Hecate makes eye contact with me. She whispers to Kynheart in his ear, and they kiss. She's wearing that blue shift again, just like the trip over to Saxony. She joins me at the rear of the boat.
Apprentice, are you okay?
I turn and stare at the other ships, all nearby with lighted torches on their prows, and give a weak shrug. She moves a small sack of food next to me and sits on it. Everyone keeps asking me what I'm going to do when we reach Britannia, I say in a flat tone. I look at her. What do you think Thorin will say when we reach Britannia? She lifts an eyebrow and smirks.
I pray he says nothing at all.
I intend to see Kynhard cut his head away from his body with one of those axes. I nod. So, you and Kynhard, huh? She tilts her head to look at the other men drinking and laughing. I slip my near hand into the folds of my cloak and stick my fingers into a small leather pouch in an inside pocket. Kynhard is... he's like no other man. She takes a small sip of her ale. The sky is beautiful out here. Where I'm from, the sky looks very different. She leans back and takes in the view. I remove a pinch of the pulverized material from the small pouch and sprinkle it in her drink, careful not to spill any on her hand. She looks at me and smiles. In your own way, apprentice, you too are like no other man. How could the sky possibly be different from where you are from? Well, for starters, the moon is covered in lights, the dark part at least. I take a large drink from my ale, and she does the same. Why are there lights on the moon? I think because of the people that live there. She squints at me. How did they get there? Mostly by Vasimir engine ships, some with old school chemical rockets though. Ever since they found water ice at the poles, and helium-3 in most of the craters, people have been moving there in droves. Her head sways, almost lazily. Are you telling me a story? She smiles. Smiles like she's blitzed. She swallows. I may be. Yes. I was.
Let me tell you this, apprentice. When I bear children for Kynhard, they won't be weak like the children I bore Thorium.
She gets a smug, arrogant look on her face, then drinks the rest of her drink, dregs and all, slamming the horn cup down a bit harder than seems sensible. Why do you think Thorium's children were weak?
Thorium is weak, so of course his children would be the same. I bore that sniveling imbecile a son. Thorium was off in Rome for one of his stupid schemes. I went into seclusion towards the end of my pregnancy. At the birth, I dismissed all the servant girls and bore the child myself. I thought of keeping the little thing, but when Thorium's face flashed through my mind's eye, I knew I could do no such thing. I wrapped the cord around the little neck and pulled it tight until it turned blue-gray and stopped breathing. When I allowed the servant girls back into my chambers, all they saw was a stillborn child. She giggles and holds up her cup for another drink. Empty? I ask. I reach into the pouch again and drop a pinch of the mushroom crumbles into my own cup and hand it to her. She makes an exaggerated bow, then takes several gulps from my tankard. You told me about your son, Titus, on the way here to Saxony. She slowly licks her lips. Her eyes look dull and sleepy. She leans toward me. Titus. She says the name as if it has a funny taste on her tongue. I have a daughter, too. She gives a self-satisfied gesture. Why did you keep her? She pulls back, dipping her head down. I'm not supposed to talk about her. Did Thorium tell you not to talk about her? No.
She puts two fingers on her lips and suppresses more laughter.
No. He doesn't even know she exists. After I told him about his first child dying at birth, it was no great surprise for a second to do the same.
The others laugh a little louder, and I glance their way. Kynhard looks over at me, and holds his ale cup in the air as a toast. I nod in reply, and they return to their conversation. If Thorium doesn't want you to talk about your daughter, that's okay, I say, hoping it will do the trick. Her face turns very sour.
Thorium.
She nearly spits the name.
Thorium no longer has sway over me. He could curl up and die. I hope he dies a painful death, just like he inflicted on his father. Like the death his grandfather inflicted on himself.
Damn it, I need an audio recorder for this,
I tell myself. How did Thorium's father die? I heard Thorium had him.
Thorium had his father's head cut off. But it took that weakling 4 strokes to have the job done.
I stifle the urge to shudder. Instead, I take a deep breath. Thorium's father?
Claudius.
She takes a sip of ale.
Claudius Pentavian something or other.
What did he do to deserve that?
He kept his little secret from Thorium.
What secret?
A secret about his inheritance.
I know, Thorium is basically the king of Britannia now. Londonium, at least. She shakes her head.
No. There is another inheritance.
She looks around, then cups her hand on her mouth against my ear.
Thorium's grandfather had claim to the Imperatus, the entire Empire of Rome, but he refused to press his claim, knowing it would plunge the Empire into more civil war. He told Claudius his secret, but they did not tell Thorium.
She leans back and seems to repress laughter. Why didn't they tell him? She shrugs.
I presume it's because they knew his way.
She smiles broadly.
Can you imagine how Thorium would behave right now if he knew he had a claim to the purple?
But if he doesn't know, why did he kill his father? She snorts.
Because he knew his father was keeping a secret. He just didn't know what it was.
Thorium told me he intended to torture the secret out of his father.
But unlike Thorium, Claudius was made from iron. He said nothing. After Thorium had his head stricken from his body, his men threw the corpse into the Thames and let it be washed out to the sea.
She drinks more.
Who else knows this? Thorium's grandfather, Antiphony Claudius Thorleum. He was a slippery rat, too.
3 generations?
I'm certain Antiphony told his friend, Orestes.
I catch my breath.
Orestes? I remember he said something about killing pigs at Hadrian's Wall with him. Yes. He was Antiphony's closest friend.
Wait. So, Thorium's grandfather had a claim to the Imperatus? That means Thorium himself has a claim?
How does he not know that? Antiphony burned down his estate around him, so the secret would die with him.
She snorts a derisive laugh.
Fool! I know he had a signet ring, along with documents from many legatees showing his lineage. From time to time, proconsuls would send messages to him, begging for him to intervene in imperial events. I made sure those were all kept safe from the flames just before he burned everything. Tired old fool probably thought it was still in there.
I start to ask another question, but I can't think of what to say. She leans forward again.
I learned of this after my first child. Had I known, I may have kept him. I may never be the Emperor, but to be the mother of the Emperor, mother of the Empress,
arches one eyebrow and brushes some of her black hair aside. What about being the wife of the Emperor with Thorium?
I would be the Empress of nothing. Everything Thorium touches turns to dust.
She finishes my ale, letting the cup slip from her fingers. It falls with a solid thud. She swoons, and I lurch forward to catch her. She whispers in my ear,
"That means my daughter is the next Imperatus. I must find her. I must find my Gwyneth."
She turns to dead weight. Kynard and the others, alarmed by her dropping of the cup, come over to me.
"She normally not gets this drunk."
Kynard purses his lips.
"I'm sure the stress of going back to Britannia isn't helping either," Lysirin says.
Kynard nods, and I gently pass Hecate into his arms. He carries her to another place in the boat and lays her down, covering her with a tan goat hide. I grab Praxos's elbow and say very quietly,
"I need to talk to you."
If you enjoyed this show, consider picking up a copy of the book on Amazon or through the website at twilighthistories.com. It's our first Twilight Histories book, and Josh has put a huge amount of effort into it, expanding the story and making sure it was edited and beta tested. It's a solid, well-crafted book, and if you enjoy listening to it, why not have it on your shelf? When you purchase it, please give it a generous rating on Amazon. This will help the book get picked up by Amazon search engines, so it will be visible to others. You can find the book on Amazon by running a search for Josh Hutchins or Romano-Saxon War, or by going to the website at twilighthistories.com. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening, and take care.